Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is TV Take, Variety's television podcast. I'm Daniel Holloway. Today we talk with John Bradley, who plays Samuel Tarly on HBO's Game of Thrones. The final season of the fantasy drama premieres Sunday, April 14th. Later, critics Daniel Daddario and Caroline Framke will talk about Game of Thrones and new masterpiece miniseries Les Miserables. Then we'll talk with Joe Otterson about what The End of Thrones means for HBO, for TV, and the world. Stay tuned. John Bradley, thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me. What a pleasure.
So, not that anyone who watches the show needs reminding, but where did we leave Sam 20 months ago at the end of the previous season of Game of Thrones?
20 months. We really are testing people's patience this time. They normally had to wait, you know, 42 weeks for 10 episodes. This time we're making them wait 18 months for 6 episodes. It feels like a lifetime ago. But last time we saw Sam, he'd done his season at the Citadel, become completely disenchanted with that and completely dispirited by what that did to him in terms of coming up against so much resistance to his progressive, proactive ideas. You learnt a lot about him in season 7 because you really did see that he does want to make a difference, and he's not going to the Citadel for an easy life for himself. He's going there because he thinks that's the place where he can properly use the skills that he has in order to make a difference and fight the same war as everybody else is fighting, but fighting it in his own way. And I think what he did find there was a lot of people who do actually want a quiet life, and they don't want to put their head above the parapet, and they just want to eke out their last few days in relative comfort. And that angered Sam so much, in terms of he knows the importance of knowledge, he knows the importance of academia, and he knows that there are secrets in amongst all those books that can affect things, that can change the whole course of this war and the whole course of history. But the people he encountered there didn't seem to believe in it as much as he did. They were just completely down to, you know, push the pen and have as quiet a life as possible. And so Sam left the Citadel in kind of one of the lowest states we've ever seen him, but also galvanized as well. One of the lowest states because that seat of learning was what he aspired to his entire life. He had this idea of the Citadel as a kind of over the rainbow place where, you know, you're telling me there's a place where academia and knowledge is prized and I'm not going to be an outcast because I can't fight. He always saw that as a place where he belonged after not belonging anywhere. Didn't belong at home, didn't belong in the Night's Watch. And then he gets there and he finds that he doesn't belong there either. He's an outsider again and an outcast again because his ideas are too progressive. So he's dispirited about that because he's invested so much into this place that just completely let him down. But he's also galvanized because he's worked out that being accepted into these institutions isn't important. It's about adhering to your own moral code and not letting rules and scripture and regulations get in the way of what you consider to be right. So he's kind of buoyed by the fact that now he doesn't have to follow anybody else's rules. He's guided by his own principles and his own sense of right and wrong. And his own sense of right and wrong is to protect people that need protecting, to protect the people that he loves in terms of Gilly and Baby Sam most of all, but also go back to Winterfell and go back to the thick of it and get right back into the middle of the action. And we saw him at the end of season 7 in his final moments back at Winterfell, or at Winterfell for the first time in Sam's case, with Bran Stark. And you know, there are certain key pieces of information in season 7 that were revealed, and Sam and Bran get together to discuss what they're going to do with that knowledge. And that was really exciting for me because as an actor, especially in a show where there are so many characters and so many worlds and it's such a vast landscape, the one thing that you want to feel more than anything is important. even if you don't necessarily have as much screen time as other people, or, you know, it's not exactly at the very, very center of things in terms of a Jon Snow or a Daenerys or a Tyrion. What you want to feel is, this show isn't going to end the same way as it would have if I wasn't here. And I think that for the last couple of years, the season six with the journey down to the Citadel, which took a whole season, and then pretty much a whole season at the Citadel, we've been happy with, in terms of me and Hannah, we've been happy with the work that we've been doing, but we have felt slightly on the outskirts and like satellite characters almost, with our own narrative and our own story that is, you know, connected to the main thrust of it, but we're just not right in the centre of it and not right where the action is. And this, you know, coming at the end of season seven and going into season eight, we feel right back at the heart of things again, and that's always very exciting. And I think what you'll get most of all this season is a lot of people coming together, and there's now a kind of, there's a real epicenter of all the action, and it all kind of gravitates around one place, and to have Sam and Gilly right back in the heart of that was really exciting.
Well, as an actor, I mean, what's the trade-off, right, for what you just described for the last two seasons? Because on one hand, you know, you described it as a satellite narrative.
Yeah.
But it's also your narrative. So you're at the center of most of your own scenes, as opposed to, you know, there were certainly scenes in previous seasons where maybe Sam was just like, yeah, that's a great idea, John.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you view it as like a plus-minus situation?
It's definitely a plus-minus situation. And I genuinely couldn't be any happier with my narrative arc over the course of this the whole series, not just necessarily because of Sam's progression as a character, but also in terms of my experience of experiencing being known and experiencing fame for the kind of, you know, to use a kind of what's turned into quite a vulgar term these days, but to experience fame that way, where you start off in this big thing, but you are more peripheral and you are more background, and you do occupy a sidekick space, and that's fine. That's really nice to have a couple of seasons like that, where not all of the attention is on you. You can still do work, and you can still affect things, and you can still be satisfied artistically, but your photo isn't everywhere. You're not like an Amelia or a Kit, where they went from obscurity suddenly into leading this huge thing and being known everywhere and the whole world being interested in them. I never had that. Mine was a very gentle path towards my own narrative. And by the time I had it, where Sam takes Gilly away from Craster's and they make their way back to Castle Black in the second half of season three, we'd been doing the show 2.5 years then. So I felt that that was the first time I was really able to carry a narrative on my own. So I didn't really feel the pressure of it early on, and I'm very happy with that. And I'd like to think that, you know, satellite, and I keep using like satellite and peripheral to talk about my seasons and my storyline, but I genuinely do think that they have a different, unique texture to them that I don't think is necessarily in the rest of the series. And you know, in terms of Sam and Gilly's blossoming relationship when they were together, they had a couple of seasons together. That's much slower pace, and it's more gentle, and it feels very human. And, you know, their relationship of two slightly maladjusted people falling in love, that doesn't necessarily have to be in a fantasy landscape. That can be anywhere. That can be two characters from any show who have a lot of psychological boundaries and are very battle scarred, and they feel they've been kicked around by life. They fall in love and they start to lean on each other, and they encourage each other to grow. That's not a fantasy trope at all. That's a dramatic trope, but that can be in anything. And you know, in terms of the work that I did later on with Jim Broadbent in season seven, that felt great, because that was a much more slower, much more kind of exploratory, verbose, still dramatic, but it felt more kind of theatrical in a way, because there was a lot of talking. And I really enjoyed that, because I think that does bring a unique flavor to things, and you don't feel that you are necessarily just wasting screen time on a satellite thing, because you're bringing something to the show that isn't necessarily found anywhere else. So you do still feel important in terms of the overall pacing and the overall light and shade. But sometimes you do miss out on the action a little bit. And I found that particularly interesting when people come up and say, oh, you know, we like Game of Thrones. And I say, oh, great. And thank you very much. And they say, well, yeah, Battle of the Bastards, that was my favorite episode. What an amazing episode. And I don't know what to say because I'm not in it. I'm not saying that's why it's their favorite. But you don't always say thank you very much because you don't feel connected to it. All you can kind of say is, yeah, I know it was great. Because you do feel that about episodes that you're not in. There's so much you're not in. You can watch the rest of it like a fan watches it. But it feels a strange kind of disconnect where I feel tangentially involved in it because I'm involved in a lot of the show. But when people talk about certain moments that I'm not involved in, I can't claim ownership of them because I had no input. I can just kind of enjoy it like everybody else.
I would also think that for anyone who's a fan of the show, which is not like a select group of people, the most popular show in the world, that if you really did enjoy that episode, you would realize, oh, the guy that I'm talking to right now is not actually in that episode.
Yeah. That's kind of true. But it all feeds into everything because Battle of the Bastards as an episode only works because over the course of not only that season, but the series as a whole up to that point, they'd invested a lot of time in these characters and in terms of their motives and in terms of, you know, what they want from life, what their principles are, who, you know, where they stand on the kind of moral spectrum. About a big epic cinematic battle episode like that is only really effective if you know what it means to every single person in it. And there's a jeopardy there. A lot of people, you know, think, oh, imagine if every episode was like that, what an amazing show it'd be. But it wouldn't, because it wouldn't mean anything. Battle of the Bastards only works because you know what it means to Jon Snow. And they've done all of that, laying that groundwork of everybody's where everybody is psychologically. And then that's the kind of climax of it all, where it all, there's fireworks because it's all coming to a head. And it only happens when it's designed to happen. And if Battle of the Bastards is a great episode as it is, if that was your first episode of the series, the first episode anybody ever seen, it'd be a great visual experience, but there'd be no heart to it. And I think that one thing that this show does, as well as it does, you know, the kind of things on a larger scale, is they do talking really well and they do characters really well. And some of the most affecting scenes in it are just two characters talking. So to get that balance, I think there's something for everybody in there. And we don't kid ourselves. We kind of think that so many people like Game of Thrones and there's so many reasons to like it. There may be certain people who may find Sam and Gilly's journey towards falling in love and journey towards healing their scars to be quite unsatisfying and quite frustrating because they want to see battles. And that's fine. You'll get a battle eventually. But I think for people who are more invested in a slow burn examination of two damaged people, there's that for them as well. And, you know, everybody has something in there that they like. And the fact that everybody's got different favorite characters, and not only everybody's got different favorite characters, every character is probably someone's favorite character. All of that stuff takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of man hours to get those characters to a point where people care about them. It's only if people care about a character that they care if they live or die. And if they don't care if they live or die, a battle doesn't mean anything. So the show really does have something for everybody, and it respects all levels of viewership, all ages. And one of the things that I think makes the show such a success is that as a fantasy show, it's not what anybody sees when they look out of their window. And that's why it's become global. Because if you take a show like Sopranos, one of my favorite shows, but if you live in New Jersey, you can probably connect to it slightly more readily than somebody in Tokyo can,
right,
for example. They still love it as a drama, but it just feels slightly closer to home. With Game of Thrones, everybody all over the world has to make that intellectual leap. And everybody has to go to Westeros mentally before they can experience it. And because of that, it's a great unifying thing.
The foreignness of it is the thing that makes it kind of universal.
It makes it universal, everybody kind of joins hands and takes that leap together. And that's why I think it is so popular, because it unites people and there's something for everybody in there, depending on what you want and yeah, that doesn't kind of happen by accident. It's a lot of hard work and graft on the part of David and Dan.
You got cast shortly out of school, yeah?
I was still at drama school when I did the first audition, yeah. I was at the end of a 3-year course, being trained in drama, and yeah, that seems like a lifetime ago now.
At what point during, because you've been with this character, this show, since nearly the beginning, at what point, not having the perspective of having really had, you know, a career before getting cast, at what point did you realize, this thing is going to be different than most other things?
That's an interesting question, because I think going all the way back to season one, none of us had any indication of how big it was going to be. It's different for people who've joined the show later on, because they know what they're joining. There's a frame of reference, especially people who've joined from, say, after season three, where the momentum really started to build and, you know, the PR campaigns became so much bigger and everybody started to be aware of it. Even if they didn't watch it, they were aware of it, and it kind of was starting to establish its place in the cultural landscape. But going back to when we started, I don't think we realized, but David and Dan certainly realized, and HBO realized, just how much of a gamble it was, because HBO had never done anything like it before. And fantasy, back then, I think we've got rid of a lot of those boundaries and a lot of that prejudice. Fantasy did feel like a niche thing that was aimed at a certain fan base and a certain demographic. And so I think they thought, you know, are we going to be able to have a show that appeals to people who like The Wire and people who like Lord of the Rings? And that may not have happened. That just may not have happened. Somebody would be like, oh, you remember that Game of Thrones show that had one season and it sank without trace? Oh, yeah, remember that. But we've never really concerned ourselves with how big the show is, because that's up to everybody else. When you're on a set in Belfast and you're talking to Kit Harington across the table, you can't possibly hold it in your mind how big it is, because you'll get crushed under it. You'll get crushed under the expectation of it and what it means to people. And if you're doing a scene and you know that, you know, President Obama's going to watch it, you're not going to be able to feel the scene and feel the moment. So I think we've always been more interested in making a good show rather than the big show. I think the size of it in terms of how many people watch it, that takes care of itself. But nobody's going to really watch it if it's not good. But I think because we shoot it in primarily in Belfast, but in Spain and bits of Iceland and Croatia and places, it's only when we really come to America, when we start to come to America for our season three premiere, was our first year that we did a premiere in LA. And that's when you start to feel that you're involved in something that is global, because it doesn't necessarily feel like an American show when you're filming it, because you're in Northern Ireland. It's primarily a local crew and an English crew, and David and Dan are always there, but it can almost feel like a local project sometimes, because everything's quite insular and you see the same people every year, and the place that you're filming this show has the same supermarkets and the same TV channels and all that stuff is home. It doesn't necessarily feel like you're in an American thing. But when we came to LA in must have been 2013 for our season three premiere, that's when we first started to think, oh, well, we're one of those shows now. Because you see premieres on telly and the big American shows that you're in awe of, and sometimes it's hard to place yourself in that. You just don't see yourself as being part of that lineup of shows. But that was the first indication that, oh, we may be one of those shows, and we may be global. And as much as you try and resist those thoughts, because, you know, as I've said, that you sometimes can't cope with that, the magnitude of that expectation, or, you know, the idea that you're in a show that's as big as Sopranos was, that's almost hard to imagine sometimes, because when you're in something, you've got a completely different relationship than everybody else has. I remember being with Kit at Comic Con, I think, that same year, and we were talking about Sopranos, and I just said, I was watching it at the time, and I was like, I just don't feel we're ever going to get there. I just don't feel we're ever going to get there and just be as respected and as revered as that show is. And Kit was like, no, I don't think we will either. And that's so weird to think of now, because that was going into season three. We've done so many seasons since then. It's almost like, do you know when you're at school and you're in the first year of school, and then you get a guy in the third year of school, or, you know, and he seems like 20 years older than you.
Yeah.
And he seems so much more adult, and he just seems so much more impressive. And no matter what you go through life, even if you're 47 and he's 50, he always feels like he's out of your reach, that you're never going to get there. You're never going to be that adult. And I think that's how we feel about other shows, that they set such a template and we're pointless. It's pointless even us trying to get there, because they're always going to be something that we can never achieve. And I'm sure shows are going to think that about us as well, but in the same way that people thought that about you when you were in third year of school, first years thought that about you. You're constantly playing catch up, and that's a good thing in a way. It's good to be ambitious, and it's good to have standards that you set yourself. But as soon as you reach your standards, as soon as we start to bowl around thinking, oh, we're as big as Sopranos, then that's when a little bit of the magic would wear off. You should always be aiming for something, and we're aiming for that standard. And yeah.
Are you comfortable, crossed, though, now with the idea that you guys are as big as Sopranos? Because you are, by any measure, the show is.
Still not really. And it's an interesting thing being in it, because when you see Sopranos, you just see it as a finished, polished product. And you almost, even if you've been in TV for years or film for years, you don't see the work. You just see it as a piece of art. You don't see, you can if you want, I'm sure, but you don't see outtakes. You don't see bits of ADR. You don't see people suddenly standing in the wrong place. Or you don't see those little fluffs and those little mistakes that are going to be in there, but you just don't see them because you just see it from an outsider's point of view. But when I watch the show a lot of the time, especially my own performance, I have to think, oh, that ADR is a little bit obvious and I didn't quite sit in the right place there. You can't quite see this side of my face. And you see the imperfections of it. And because you see the imperfections that nobody else would see, because they're tiny, really, it kind of mars your version of it, your kind of perception of it somehow. It's like when the Beatles started to release, every year they do it now, they release a big box set with outtakes and demos and stuff. And some people find that interesting. I've always resisted that because I think I'd like to see it as complete. I don't want to hear all the time. It's perfect. I don't want to hear all the time they got it wrong and all the stuff that wasn't good enough to make it. I just want to see it as a perfect thing. And if you're in it and you're involved in that process, you can't see beyond some of those little imperfections of things. So I think that's why we see ourselves as them being on a different level, because we weren't there for that what I'm sure was a very grueling and ultimately satisfying, but a hard process. We never saw that. We just see the final product, and that's why our relationship to it's different, I think.
What about Sam's journey has surprised you? Like, where has he gone that you maybe didn't expect?
One of the things that I find so interesting about that journey is the fact that a lot of people ask, what has he learned about himself? He's clearly learned a lot about himself over the course of the series, but I think it's more important to think of what he's unlearned about himself. Because when you first see him in that very first episode, he's clearly somebody who is crippled by insecurity and self-doubt and doesn't believe he's worth anything, and says in his first scene that he's a coward. My father always called me a coward. And I think that's quite crucial, because if you're born into that environment and raised in an environment as an impressionable child where somebody's constantly telling you you're no good and you're a coward and you're going to be a liability for the rest of your life, you're going to believe it. And that's the thing about Sam. He's just believed everything that he was told about himself at home. And he gets to Castle Black and you just see somebody who's completely devoid of any self-confidence or any feeling of self-worth. And over the course of the series, it's not that he acquires things. He just loses all of that. He loses all of that baggage, and those emotional scars heal. And he finds out that he was brave enough all along, and he should never have listened to people who told him that he wasn't, because he kills the first person to kill a White Walker, he falls in love and takes on the mantle of parenthood, he achieves all of these things, and slowly but surely you see him start to think, well, maybe they were wrong about me, and maybe I actually am brave. And it's a three-way journey because Sam experiences all of that, those changes in him and that process of unlearning and stripping away all the layers and finding that beating heart inside him, which is Brave. The audience go on the same journey because they're forgiven for thinking when they first see him that he's all the things that his father said he is, because they've got no reason to think otherwise. And so they see him grow and they see what he achieves. And myself as an actor as well, I got to go on that journey with him. And it's a very transformative narrative in terms of how he starts episode 4 of season 1, where he comes into it, and how he finishes all the way down to the end of season 7. That it's almost like a different person. You're seeing somebody with so much more toughness about them and guile about them. And you get that, or Sam gets that, through achievement. He had to achieve all of this stuff before he really give himself a shot. I think that's the most surprising thing, that just where he ends up, you just don't think he's got the potential for it when you first see him, and because he didn't believe he had the potential for it himself. And so that awakening, it's been a slow burn. There's no quick transformations, and that's what comes from having 10 hours a season to live with these characters and all these seasons over the course of even over the course of a trilogy like Lord of the Rings. It's still only where 9 hours or something. That's not even a season for us. So a lot of those kind of psychological and emotional journeys have to be sped up or have to be expedited to the final point. But with us, the change is almost imperceptible. The same way if you really kind of look at a clock, you won't see the time change, and you've got to look away and then look back. If you put season 1, any of these characters, and then season 7, the same characters side by side, they've changed unbelievably. Not physically, yes, because the actors have, but in terms of their emotions, their psychology, what they've learned, the experiences they've had. They're just different people, and that's why it's such a privilege to play that in, over the course of 8 seasons, where, the constant development and the constant putting them in situations that they've never been in before. That's why you've ended up with this cast of unbelievably rich characters, because you've been with them throughout all these experiences and seen how it's changed them, and you feel like you've lived a whole lifetime with them by the end of season 7, and especially going into season 8, where I think a lot of stuff's going to come to a head, and a lot of those those journeys, narratively in terms of the show, those journeys are going to end.
John, thanks very much.
Thank you. What a pleasure. Thanks so much, man.
I'm Michael Schneider, inviting you to join me each week on the Variety podcast, My Favorite Episode. It's where stars and producers gather to discuss their favorite TV episodes ever, from classic sitcoms to modern-day dramas, as well as pick a favorite episode from their own series. Our guests aren't just making great TV, they watch it too, and they're big fans just like you. On My Favorite Episode, some of the biggest names in TV share their creative inspirations and how those episodes influence them. You'll not only learn the secrets behind the most popular shows currently on television, but you'll get to celebrate the greatest TV of all time. New episodes drop every Monday. Find it and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
The masterpiece adaptation of Victor Hugo's Les Miserables debuts April 14th, the same night as the last season of Game of Thrones. Daniel Daddario and Caroline Franke talk about both shows.
This week, we are discussing a literary adaptation that hits April 14th. It is a sweeping story of characters enmeshed in political upheaval in a world that looks very different from our own. That's right. This is PBS's Les Miserables.
Yeah.
Yeah. We will get to Game of Thrones, but for right now, we are enjoying the Paris of Victor Hugo, and we are not enjoying any of the music because this is not an adaptation of the beloved Broadway musical. All the characters are here, but they're not singing. They're just fighting for their rights and their lives on the streets of Paris. So, Caroline, you reviewed Les Mis for us. I am looking forward to screening, but I have not yet. Walk me through kind of the universe this creates.
Sure. So this is a 6-part miniseries. As you said, very sweeping, very epic. They clearly spent some money on this. It's a co-production with the BBC. So it has already aired in the UK, if you are listening from there and are like, we already did this. We have not over here. It comes to us from Andrew Davies, who if you don't recognize his name, you may have seen his work. He's known for literary adaptations. In this vein, he is responsible for the 1995 Pride and Prejudice. He's done Bleak House, Vanity Fair, War and Peace. This is his lane. And the thing I always think of is at this winter's Television Critics Winter Press Association tour. I think I just jumbled all the words. Yeah. But it was a TV Critics tour in January. He was talking about why he wanted to do this. And he was asked about the musical. And he straight up said, oh, I hated the musical. I wanted to rescue this book from the musical. He was very blunt about it. David Oyelowo, who plays Javert, was horrified and tried to stick up for the musical. But the point is that Davies wanted to bring it sort of back down to earth, really flesh out some of the plot lines that the musical did not, and sort of return the gravity to the text. I think for the most part it does that. It certainly has time to, with 6 hours. Every hour is a solid hour, so it is 6 full hours. And the cast is stacked, as well as Oyelowo. There's Dominic West as Valjean, who's fantastic. I have not actually seen West in that much. I didn't watch The Affair, but he's incredible in this, and he has to shoulder a lot. And there is Lily Collins as Fantine, and she gets a little bit more to do than Fantine usually does in adaptations. You get to see her life before she was made... She fell into poverty, so you sort of get more of a sense of how much she's lost and how easy it is, or how easy it was. Well, is. I mean, yeah. Part of the adaptation, too, is kind of pointing out how much still resonates today in terms of income inequality and class structure. Also, Olivia Colman is in this in a part that, as I said in my review, she could have done in her sleep. She's been doing parts like this forever. She plays the sort of evil innkeeper's wife.
Oh, yeah, Madame Thénardier, right? Mm-hmm. And that is traditionally in the musical, that's a big, broad comic role.
Right, and she is funny with this, but, you know, this is not a funny adaptation, I would say. She brings humor to it because she can do that so easily as she did in The Favorite, but it is a smaller part than maybe the promotional materials are now suggesting after she won her Oscar.
Right.
But... overall, I think if you're a fan of literary adaptations, if you have any sort of passing interest in Les Mis, this is a really handsome production, very well acted. I sort of lost some interest towards the end, I think, and I think the musical has trouble with this too. Once you get to the rebellion outside of the intimate family stuff, you're like, who are these people? What are we doing? I know this is important, but we haven't really gotten to know them until suddenly they're rebelling. So around, you know, the 4th, 5th episode, it starts to lag a little bit, but it ends strong, and I think it will be a good big thing for PBS. The fact that they're premiering it opposite Game of Thrones same night means that they're at least confident they can find people who might not be watching Game of Thrones, or that they have their own audience, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I feel like recent Masterpiece installments really have kind of found a very devoted audience in the post-Downton world. Like, I know... that people really love Victoria and Poldark, mm-hmm. and they are not necessarily people who are super plugged into the Game of Thrones is of the world, into right. the what's hot and buzzy and on the cover of magazines yeah. shows of the world. So
PBS knows they have an audience. Yes. They're counting on that, and you know they're airing 6 episodes opposite Game of Thrones, which also has
6 episodes.
6 episodes. So let's talk Game of Thrones.
Yeah, let's talk Game of Thrones. I feel like... it's interesting going from talking about this show that has so much to say about income inequality and the state of the world by conjuring a bygone world, and then going to talk about Game of Thrones, which in its earliest going, I think was a really sharply political show with a lot on its mind.
Mm-hmm.
I will say I am not talking in this segment about the 8th season. I have seen... the first episode of the 8th season at the premiere in New York City. I'm not talking about it. It is strictly embargoed. Talking about the 7th season, which aired 2 years ago, I feel as though in becoming the biggest and grandest show in the world, with all that it has to offer, in terms of the grandeur and the spectacle, I feel like it lost a little bit of its subtler tonalities, a little bit of its ability to comment on things. I feel like some characters have gotten a little bit lost. I do love watching it in part because of the absolute spectacle of the dragons, of the sets, of the costumes, and of some of the really wonderful performances. But I do feel like I miss the show that had really keen and sharp insights about power and what it makes people do.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was telling you sort of earlier, I was sick a couple weeks ago and I didn't have the wherewithal to watch new shows. So I figured I would start Game of Thrones from the beginning again because I hadn't rewatched the first season in such a long time. And I was sitting there and I was like, is it the fever or is this an incredible family drama? And I think it really was, because it could be on that smaller scale, because it really committed to that. And I agree that once it became this phenomenon, it sort of, and understandably wanted to push the boundaries of what TV had done, could do in terms of budget, spectacle, the whole thing. And I will admit that when we found out that the last season would be 6 expanded episodes, not all of them are feature length. We found out the episode lengths, a couple of them are. I was nervous because I was like, are we just doing that so that we can have bigger, splashier battle scenes? Not all of which I think the show even needed, a couple, sure, but are we just doing this because we can do it? So I'm really hoping that in this last season, as they wind down everyone's stories, they kind of can bring it back to the basics of what made them so compelling in the first place.
And I think there's a good chance that that will happen. I think that, like many shows, The Americans comes to mind.
Mm.
The penultimate season of The Americans, which was made when they knew they had 2 seasons left to go,
was fine.
Was fine and was widely criticized for wheel spinning. I didn't think it was necessarily horrible, and some people really hated it, but I think it was just good enough, and I think it basically nothing happened, which is not, it's not all about the plot, but that is a little problematic. And similarly, on the penultimate season of Game of Thrones, there were some huge, wonderful battle scenes, sure, but the plot felt pretty stalled, in especially with certain characters who'd been really dynamic over the course of the run. I'm thinking of the season-long impasse about whether or not Jon would bend the knee to Daenerys, which they're great characters and they played the scenes well, but it became to be a bit repetitive because they had all the good stuff was going to happen in the final season. So my hope is that those characters get great, interesting, characterful stuff to play in the final hours.
Yeah, I think I'm really looking forward to it. I think it was, especially after just watching that first season again, it is pretty incredible how far some of the characters and actors have come.
Yes.
Watching them grow up in these roles has been really fascinating. I'm in the tank for Sansa, but I think part of that is because Sophie Turner brought a lot to a role that I think a lot of people dismissed. I don't know. I think I'm just really interested to see how it plays out, not even as an existing fan of the books or anything, but just because this has been such a huge part of the TV landscape since 2011, its absence will be felt. For the past couple years, you can see studios and networks trying to find the next thing, even if it's not quite as literal as the Game of Thrones prequel that is in production with HBO, but people want to fill this gap, and I don't know how that's going to happen or if it quite can, but I'm really fascinated to see how they wrap it up.
Yeah, I think that this ending feels, at the same time as Veep, which similarly has been an Emmy darling and is also in its final season right now, feels like the end of an era for HBO, which is currently under new ownership. It also feels like a bit of an end of an era for our culture. I feel like this show occupied an extremely special place, both by dint of the things it had to say over the course of a decade of extreme political precarity in our world, but also by dint of the way that it was just the thing that consumed all the oxygen. In television, it was the show that was able to be discussed at real and virtual water coolers. So it's going to be interesting to see what we as television writers get up to writing about in its absence in a few weeks. But until then, there's always more TV where that came from.
Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones, Game of Thrones, Game of Thrones. We talked with Joe Otterson, Variety TV reporter, about Game of Thrones. Joe, we've spent a lot of time in this episode talking about Game of Thrones, but given your expertise as a crack television trade reporter, wanted to talk to you for a minute about what the show coming to an end means for HBO and for the television landscape as a whole.
Mm-hmm. One thing
that's not a question. That's just a mission statement for this conversation.
One thing we've been talking about a lot is, you know, with Game of Thrones ending, this seems to kind of be like the end of appointment TV as we know it, like to the point where, you know, people like where you have to watch the show day and date, you know, it comes out, because if you don't, you're going to be so far behind. So, I mean, this is also like one of those shows, I think, that's, you know, I mean, to rally an audience of, you know, 20 million people a week. I mean, the chances of that happening in the future are probably pretty slim, barring some kind of like massive event series or something. You know what I mean? If Julia Roberts and Meryl Streep, you know, combine forces into some sort of like superhero Marvel thing, which I would actually really pay to see. Can we just do that instead of Game of Thrones?
Sounds great. I'm greenlighting it right now.
I would watch that. But in terms of what this means for HBO, obviously it's a huge loss for them, even though they've obviously seen this coming, you know, for some time. But they have the prequel pilot currently in the works with Naomi Watts. And as I've said before, I mean, I think there's basically no chance that doesn't get picked up. I mean, because just given how rabid the fan base is for this show, unless the pilot comes in just completely below everybody's expectations, which even that may not disqualify them, because as we know, Game of Thrones shot an entire pilot, you know, before the one we eventually saw. You know, they shot a pilot that they ended up reshooting significantly, and that turned into the show that has, you know, captivated the world. But HBO also has a lot of really good stuff coming out this year, too. They got the final season of Veep. They've got Watchmen coming out. Big Little Lies comes back. So, I mean, they're not going to be hurting for quality programming, but it's definitely a loss for them.
The show, and you probably are more up to date on the numbers than I am. The show gets about 20 million viewers per episode on HBO in the U.S.?
Yeah, I don't have an exact number in front of me right now, but I think, like, last season, it like started off around like 16 million, like, and that's just live same day. And then when you factor in delayed viewing, multi-platform viewing, I mean, I got to imagine that's around 20 million. Yeah.
So can you put that in some context? I mean, first of all, we know HBO is not as widely distributed as, say, a broadcast network or a basic cable network. So you're starting from a smaller pool of viewers.
Mm-hmm.
How rare is it for a television show these days to get that, not just that many people watching, but to get that many people watching live?
Well, it's funny, I mean, because, you know, CBS routinely draws a very big audience, but the difference is with Game of Thrones that Game of Thrones also draws a very, very large audience in the key adult 18 to 49 demographic amongst younger viewers, whereas CBS audience is typically older. So that's
older viewers being less inclined to use DVRs and watch things digitally
precisely
on their phones.
But yeah, so I mean that's the big though like factor that sets Game of Thrones apart from any other show on TV, is that it is just unbelievably popular across a pretty wide segment of the population. It cuts across a lot of demographics.
What has happened to TV in the last decade since Thrones premiered? You know, I mean, it's been about 10 years. That has caused the landscape to change in such a way that people just aren't watching very many shows live. We're not having these shows that sort of function the way that Thrones does, where it is a cultural event. You got to watch it the moment that it starts.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, streaming has played a very big part in that. On-demand viewing and then binge viewing is a very big thing, which I actually still – there are certain shows that I do like to binge, but others I still really advocate for the weekly release model, just because I hate the idea that, like, let's say I'm a big fan of an hour-long drama and then, you know, Netflix or whatever, whoever drops it, you know, the entire season on a Friday, if I don't watch the entire 13-episode season, so 13 hours of television over the course of a weekend – I'm pretty much behind everybody else, you know, because there are people who, you know, will wake up, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning when a show drops and start watching it right then. And just avoiding spoilers nowadays is, I mean, it's practically a martial art. You know, you got to just be so careful about not catching spoilers for stuff you're really a big fan of. But yeah, so I think that's the biggest thing. And then, yeah, just on-demand viewing and just this idea that you can watch pretty much whatever you want, whenever you want, and now wherever you want. I mean, you know, you can carry, you know, on your phone, on your iPad, your computer, whatever. I mean, you can watch so many things at the touch of a button. I mean, so yeah, this idea of, you know, having to watch something like on a particular night at a particular time is very foreign to younger people nowadays.
Stranger Things, for instance, for Netflix. I mean, that's a show that, as best we can tell, because we can't actually see viewership numbers, but I mean, it's a phenomenon.
Yep.
On some sort of large scale. Mm-hmm. But it's not consumed or talked about the same way because those no one's going around saying like, oh, did you see this week's Stranger Things?
Right.
I mean, it is just something that is consumed. Everyone sort of eats it at their own pace, right?
Yeah, I think that's another unfortunate side effect of kind of like streaming and binge watching is that these shows have a much shorter shelf life in terms of like their, I don't want to say cultural relevance because just obviously, you know, Stranger Things is still very popular. But I mean, in terms of like for how long we'll talk about when a new season of a show drops like Stranger Things, even if it is very popular, we're not really talking about it for as long a period of time as we would with a show like Game of Thrones. Because with Game of Thrones, obviously, you know, they air one a week. There's how many episodes? Six episodes this season?
Six episodes, yeah.
Yeah, in season eight. Whereas, you know, in Stranger Things, if it's like, you know, 10, 13, whatever it is, you know what I mean? You watch all of them at once and then you're done. You know, so I think that has been an unfortunate side effect of a lot of these of the current, you know, state of television is that, you know, these shows don't get as much shelf life in the pop culture spotlight.
The end of Sopranos sort of marked an end of an era for an end of an era, rather, for HBO. And the new era was marked by the premiere of Game of Thrones in a way that was, you know, sort of could be neatly defined. I think we've all been sort of anticipating that the end of Game of Thrones would represent a new era for HBO. But given some of the things that we've seen take place in the business in the last couple months, now more than ever, it looks like HBO. We're looking at a very, very different HBO next year than we've had for the last 10 years. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, depending on what happens with, you know, the Warner Media streaming service and things. I mean, and obviously the departure of Richard Plepler, who has been, you know, a key figure at HBO for decades and a lot of executives under him subsequently who have left. I mean, yeah, it's – I mean, I can't imagine what it's going to look like in a year. I have no idea.
I mean, all that we know is that, you know, the supposed marching orders from AT&T, their new corporate parent, is they want more content. Now, whether more content means content that's necessarily as good as Game of Thrones and some shows that we've come to see in the last few years from them, like, you know, Veep and Girls and Barry and Silicon Valley and you know, some of these other shows, you know, more recently, we've had a number of key dramas come from HBO. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess it remains to be seen whether the quality will still be there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because again, I mean, just Game of Thrones, not only, that's another great point about Game of Thrones, is not only has it been, you know, this incredible cultural phenomenon, but I mean, it is an awards favorite. I mean, like the year it sat out for the Emmys, you know, when there was that big gap between the seasons most recently, that's all anyone was talking about. Like the drama race is wide open now, you know, it's anybody's race. And then as soon as Game of Thrones came back, it just, I mean, they took everything. I mean, they just came right back in and just knocked out everybody yet again, you know. So I mean, it's tough to say, man. I mean, because whether or not, you know, more content means lower quality, I think that remains to be seen. But I mean, if anybody can kind of pull off, you know, something like that, it's probably HBO. I mean, they have no shortage of experience in producing some of the best television that's ever been made. So you have to imagine, at least with that kind of institutional knowledge, that gives them a pretty significant leg up on their competition. But I mean, you know, again, in as these streaming wars start to heat up, I mean, it's anybody's race.
Cool. Joe, what house do you identify with?
I have to go with House Stark, as I am a northerner with thick northern blood. And, you know, I'm not built for this hot Southern California weather. I'm of the north. You know, I deserve better than a butcher. you Game of Thrones fans out there will get that reference to season one. I believe that's episode two. Yeah, I would say, yeah, House Stark.
All right.
King of the North.
We thank you, and we thank your thick blood for being here.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with Lake Bell and Dax Shepard of ABC's Bless This Mess.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.